So in this chapter, we're looking at an overview of evolution and microbial evolution as we've considered it thus far. And we're also looking at the evolution of resistance, such as to antibiotics that bacteria can display. And what way we're doing this is first by providing a recap, making sure everybody has a good appreciation of what it is we've talked about so far, and looking at these things, particularly in terms of microorganisms. And then we'll be applying these various concepts as they're relevant to the evolution of antibiotic resistance, especially, as well as resistance more generally. So this is our handy dandy start. So we're looking at the evolution of resistance. And we're also looking at an introduction or reintroduction or overview to microbial evolution generally. And from here, we're going to be moving on to what the core of the course is all about. So this is really the last of our introductory chapters. So bacterial resistance mechanisms. So bacteria display phenotypes that allow them to resist a number of different environmental concerns that have the potential to reduce the rate of bacterial growth and or kill bacteria. Bacteria that are able to resist these various things are potentially able to live in environments that bacteria that are sensitive to these things are unable to prosper in. So heavy metals is an example in these days of mining and various kinds of toxic waste dumps. There's lots of heavy metal contamination out there in the world. And one of the things that bacteria are able to develop resistance to is heavy metals. And an example of this would be mercury poisoning. So these are basically contamination with mercury, the Hg2 plus ion, and bacteria possess explicit resistant mechanisms to things like mercury. Bacteria are resistant to physical factors, so extremes of cold, extremes of heat, and also, for example, radiation such as exposure to UV radiation. Bacteria have a whole array of repair mechanisms against DNA damage. There's a number of, and heat shock proteins, for example, and ways of dealing with freezing, for example. So bacteria have a number of different adaptations that deal with physical extremes in their environments. Bacteria are resistant to bacteriophages. Bacteria have, again, a whole array of resistance mechanisms that they display against the viruses that are able to infect them. These include resistance mechanisms that are chromosomally located, that is, mutations in chromosomal genes, as well as extrachromosomally located resistance mechanisms, that is, such as found on plasmids. Bacteriocins either are similar to bacteriophages or similar to antibiotics. They tend to have a very narrow spectrum of activity and are a mechanism that is displayed or expressed by bacteria themselves. Generally, these are anti-competition factors, and they play a role in such as colonization of surfaces by bacteria. It allows bacteria to reduce the number of conspecifics or closely related species that are able to compete for the same locations in an environment. And then there are phagotrophic protists, so there are protozoa that consume bacteria, and bacteria have various mechanisms whereby they can combat this consumption or phagocytosis, such as the production of various kinds of toxins that also have the potential to make us sick when we ingest these bacteria, for example. Animals also prey upon bacteria, and bacteria probably have mechanisms of resistance to animals as well. The toxins that bacteria produce, for example, could block the consumption of bacteria by animals too, as well as phagotrophic protists. Plasmids. So plasmids carry genes that can be helpful to bacteria, but plasmids also have a parasitic impact on bacteria, and bacteria display various mechanisms that allow them to prevent the invasion by essentially what is parasitic DNA into their cells. If nothing else, you don't want too much of this stuff invading a cell. You need to have some way of limiting the extent to which a cell is inundated by parasitic DNA, such as that associated with plasmids. immune systems, so particularly bacterial pathogens, if they want to get very far in terms of invading into an animal's body, they're going to have to evade the immune system of that animal. And so bacteria display various mechanisms whereby they can evade immune systems. And especially if you've got a pathogen, what is a pathogen? A pathogen is basically a kind of organism that has some potential to evade the immune system of the organisms it's infecting. Otherwise, it would be eliminated before it could cause disease. And then there are antimicrobials generally. So this can include, for example, disinfectants, and there's the potential for bacteria to evolve resistance to these. And then a subset of antimicrobials is antibiotics, and bacteria certainly have a number of mechanisms that bestow antibiotic resistance upon them. So we've looked at this figure a number of times. This is looking at the evolution of antibiotic resistance. So once again, we have a bacterial population that's going along just fine, or maybe has reached its peak, and we've added antibiotic to this environment. The bacteria, for the most part, are sensitive to the antibiotic. The population crashes. As we've talked, this is an increase in mortality. It's an example of hard selection. But the population has the potential to recover if, in fact, there is some amount of antibiotic resistance that's found within that population. So this is either resistance evolution via mutation, or instead it's the population of bacteria is not clonal. So what does this mean? Well, it means that either somewhere out here there was a mutation that bestowed upon this population or individuals in this population a resistance to the antibiotic that's being applied, and this population of resistant organisms probably was not too fit compared to the rest of the population, but then they are able to recover in size. They're able to increase in frequency once the antibiotic is in the environment because suddenly they have a selective advantage relative to the sensitive bacteria in the population. Alternatively, it's possible that a single species of bacteria has been subject to horizontal gene transfer. At least some of the individuals in the population have received an antibiotic resistance gene or genes. And then, upon exposure of the population to antibiotics, these bacteria are now carrying these antibiotic resistance genes that they've received by horizontal gene transfer are suddenly selected in the environment and they come to dominate the environment. And then the third possibility is that this is not a population we're looking at, but a community of bacteria instead. A community consists of more than one species, and some of these species can have different susceptibilities to bacteria. So if you start knocking down the bacteria that are sensitive to the antibiotic, what you end up with is an increase in the number or frequency of those bacteria within the environment that are resistant to the antibiotic. Another consideration is that the resistance that the different bacteria display to the antibiotic is not uniform. There will be different degrees of resistance, which can be measured in terms of the amount of antibiotic that has to be applied in order to suppress the growth or kill these other bacteria. So there'll be a range of antibiotic resistance within the population. And you will be selecting for antibiotic resistance, but ultimately, the more antibiotic you supply, the stronger the resistance you're going to be selecting for. Another consideration here is that if you discontinue the application of antibiotics, so if a person's taking a prescription of antibiotics, and they decide they feel better and they decide to stop taking the antibiotics. What they may have done is discontinued the use of the antibiotics somewhere in here. Basically, what they've done is they've knocked down a good majority of the population, but what might be left at this point in the population are individuals that are at least a little bit resistant to the antibiotic, but perhaps not hugely resistant. And these individuals are then able to recover within the population. And now you have a population that consists of entirely at least a little bit resistant bacteria. And then if you apply the antibiotic a subsequent time, you start feeling sick again, you start taking the antibiotic. Suddenly, instead of starting with a population that's mostly sensitive, you're instead starting with a population that is mostly resistant, and therefore that population has some potential to evolve even greater resistance in the course of the rest of the application of antibiotics. Now, if you reduce the antibiotic population sufficiently, sorry, if you reduce the bacterial population sufficiently, such as within an animal, within ourselves during antibiotic treatment, it's possible that you actually don't need to reduce the population to the point where you've gotten rid of all of the bacteria, even if there are some resistant bacteria around. So long as you've reduced the population size of bacteria pathogens sufficiently, that might be enough to allow your immune system to, in fact, get on top of that population of pathogens and eliminate it from the body. So this isn't when you're treating an infection, it's not just the antibiotic that is treating the infection. The body is an important, the immune system of your body is an important component of that treatment as well. But what you don't want to do is superficially eliminate the infection, but not entirely, or not to the point where your body can just on its own get rid of the infecting bacteria. And then basically reduce these bacteria down to those that are antibiotic resistant, and then discontinue the use of the antibiotics, thus allowing the bacterial population to recover, but recover not as a fully sensitive population, but instead as a population that is at least partially resistant, and thereby providing a base upon which greater resistance can evolve. So, why do we talk about antibiotic resistance? The answer is that antibiotic resistance in bacteria is a growing problem. This graph here is showing E. coli, Enterobacter, and Klebsiella, and showing that there is an increase going from 1990 through the turn of the century of the percentage of isolates of pathogens that, in fact, are resistant to that display an antibiotic resistance. And in fact, the levels of antibiotic resistance were even lower prior to 1990. Prior to the antibiotic era, the levels of resistance were quite low, but as soon as we started applying antibiotics to infections and under other circumstances, the amount of antibiotic resistance started to grow within the population. Presumably, this demonstrates natural selection for antibiotic resistance, where the antibiotics are the selective agent. Over here shows the decline in the number of new drugs that are entering into the market. This is not really a scientific issue so much as an economic issue. The incentive for developing new drugs against antibiotics is actually not nearly as great as the incentives were 50 years ago, say. This is in part because drug companies have found that what really makes them money are treatments for chronic illnesses, things that people have to take the rest of their lives, because then they have essentially a captive audience. By contrast, if you have a highly effective antibiotic out there, a person presents with an infection, they're treated with this antibiotic for, let's say, 10 days, 2 weeks, and they don't need to be treated with the antibiotic again. So there's much less potential to earn money with regard to treatment of bacteria with antibiotics than there is in other areas of drug development. And so there simply has, as a consequence, been fewer drugs that have been coming to the market. So this increase in resistance presumably reflects natural selection. We'll be talking about that again. This decrease in the number of drugs that are available to treat antibiotics presumably represents or reflects a relative lack of economic incentive for drug companies to develop new drugs. And this is because drugs that work too well on a per-case basis, in fact, aren't used very long by the individuals that are using the drugs. And also, we don't really want to pay enormous amounts of money for antibiotics. We've gotten used to antibiotics being relatively cheap. And so, even if they're going to save our life, we're hesitant to pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to be treated with antibiotics. If for no other reason, then as a society, we're just less used to dying from bacterial infections. And so, we're less concerned about bacteria than we are, for example, are concerned about cancer and are willing to pay for expensive anti-cancer treatments. So this is a representation of the isolation of a microorganism that, in fact, produces an antibiotic. So this is a mold. It could be penicillium mold. And it is growing as a contaminant on this plate. This is streaks of bacteria. And in the course of the growing up of this bacteria, the penicillium mold has been releasing this antibiotic, presumably penicillin, some kind of penicillin, and causing a inhibition of the growth of the bacteria. So you're seeing a zone of inhibition, an area where there's relatively little antibiotic growth. Now, these molds are to a large extent decay-causing organisms, such as may be found in soils, and they therefore live in what can be described as a spatially structured environment. There's not a whole lot of mixing in their environment. So when they produce these antibacterial agents, the antibacterial agents remain in the relative vicinity of the producers of these agents, and therefore what they do is they knock down the ability of potential competitor organisms from growing in their vicinity. And if they lyse those organisms, then they're also potentially releasing nutrients that they then can consume. So it's actually easy to identify antibiotic-producing microorganisms. The hard part is finding an organism that, in fact, produces an antibiotic that's sufficiently selectively toxic. And actually, let me back up again, or go forward again. And selective toxicity basically means that the agent is more toxic against bacteria than they are against, for example, humans. So a good drug is one that does its job without hurting us. And a good antibiotic, therefore, is one that kills off the target bacteria without actually causing side effects in us. So it's relatively easy to find antibiotics. The key is finding antibiotics that affects what we're targeting, the bacteria, and not our own bodies. In addition to antibiotics, which at least traditionally have been defined as microorganism-produced chemicals that have antibacterial activities, it's also possible to modify antibiotics, and these are called semi-synthetic antibiotics. And in fact, it's also possible to just synthesize chemicals that have antibacterial activity and are selectively toxic. Chemicals that have antibacterial activity and are selectively toxic have come to be described as antibiotics, even if they weren't isolated from microorganisms. But traditionally, antibiotics were in fact isolated from microorganisms rather than synthesized de novo in the laboratory. So this is just additional examples of zones of inhibition, because the previous one wasn't as clear visually as one would like. So this is a streak of bacteria, and this is a colony of maybe some kind of fungus, but it might be some kind of soil bacterium instead. And you can see that it's producing some kind of chemical that's taking a little bite out of this streak here. That's a zone of inhibition. There's something being produced by these organisms that's diffusing away, that's interfering with the bacteria. And it's only interfering with those bacteria that are physically, spatially closest to this colony. This is probably penicillium as well, growing on a plate, and this is another streak of bacteria, and you can see clearly this zone of inhibition. Here you see some kind of presumably bacteria growing within a larger bacterial lawn, and you can see the clearing around these bacteria, and that again is an indication that some kind of antibacterial agent is being produced by these colonies. And then here you have a colony that's clearly penicillium. You can see that they're green. And here is a bacterial lawn, and here's a very large zone of inhibition around this fungal colony. This is another graph showing the increase in bacterial resistance that has been seen among pathogens over time. And if we look at this graph, basically what it is it's showing a little bit further towards the present than the previous graph we saw. And we're looking at Staphylococcus and Enterococcus and Pseudomonas and Acinobacter and also Candida. Candida is not a bacterium, but it's a pathogenic fungus, and it too is susceptible to antimicrobial agents, in that case antifungals. And you can see that there has been this gradual increase going back to the 1970s and before in the antibiotic resistance associated with pathogens. Staphylococcus is really dramatic, and this is why we care about MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus. Because basically Staphylococcus, which can cause fatal disease, there was almost no resistance going back to the 1970s. And today, approximately 60, 70 or more percent of the isolates, in fact, are resistant to methicillin, at least the isolates that are obtained in response to when a person presents with a staphylococcus-caused infection. So there's just this growing problem of resistance to antibiotics, to our major tools by which we try to control bacterial infections. And this is returning us to what essentially is the pre-antibiotic era, where we have these organisms that, rather than being able to treat trivially with doses of antibiotics, instead, these organisms are able to establish infections that we can't easily get rid of, and people are dying, and also end up being affected in nasty ways by chronic antibiotic resistance infections all over the place today in large numbers. And this is a consequence, at least in part, of these bacteria having been subjected to antibiotics over long periods of time and not necessarily the most effective ways possible. And the result has been an efficient evolution of antibiotic resistance. Although it's important to point out, as we'll see, that it's not as though antibiotic resistance was invented when the antibiotic era began. In fact, antibiotic resistance is something that occurs independent of the use by us of antibiotics. So what's changed is the movement of these antibiotic resistance genes, or otherwise acquisition of antibiotic resistance, by the organisms that otherwise are pathogenic to us. So it's not the antibiotic resistance that makes us sick, it's the pathogen that makes us sick. What antibiotic resistance does is it makes it difficult to clear the pathogen from our bodies once it's made us sick. So what are the pathogens that are problematic with regard to antibiotic resistance? So the biggie is Staphylococcus aureus. So we've got the MRSAs and the VRSAs and this thing called Aviza. The M here stands for methicillin resistant, which actually is oxicillin resistant because of replacement of methicillin by oxicillin. But it's still basically the drug of choice for Staphylococcus aureus does not work all the time anymore. R stands for resistant, as in drug resistant. In fact, MRSA sometimes is described as multi-drug resistant staphylococcus rather than methicillin resistant staphylococcus. The V stands for vancomycin, and the I stands for intermediate. So vancomycin intermediate susceptibility Staphylococcus aureus and vancomycin resistant Staphylococcus aureus. That's the frightening one. The one that basically every drug that we would prefer to limit ourselves to in treating Staphylococcus aureus, that the bug is actually resistant to these things. Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So here the M stands for, the M does not stand for drug. The N stands for multi, and the D stands for drug. And so this is multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, and the X stands for extensively. So this is extensively drug resistant tuberculosis. And this is a problem it's not unique to tuberculosis, but tuberculosis in a sense brings this on itself, because it is such a difficult disease to treat even when it is antibiotic sensitive, that people are highly motivated to not continue with the entire treatment schedule after they feel good, especially because it just goes on for months and months and months. In addition, the AIDS epidemic led to an increase in the susceptibility to tuberculosis, and therefore to tuberculosis epidemic that also resulted in the evolution of drug resistance in this pathogen. As people not so like to say, it's one thing to have, for example, HIV being drug resistant, because it's not that easy to get HIV as an infection. But Mycobacterium tuberculosis, all you have to do is breathe this stuff in, and you can become infected. And so to have Mycobacterium tuberculosis that basically is resistant to the drugs that we have for treating tuberculosis is a potential disaster, to say the least. Streptococcus pneumoniae or pneumococcus, there's a chromosomal resistance to a beta-lactam antibiotic such as penicillin that's been seen. In enterococcus, you have vancomycin-resistant enterococci. Clostridium difficile is an organism that tends to be highly antibiotic resistant. And so when we are treating for anything with antibiotics, so we can knock down the intestinal flora that's susceptible to whatever we're treating with, and the result is a Clostridium difficile overgrowth, and that gives you a Clostridium difficile associated gastroenteritis. And there also are Clostridium difficile infections, or rather pathogens, that are, for example, becoming resistant to the antibiotic Cipro. So in addition to being highly antibiotic to begin with, it's becoming even more antibiotic resistant. Acinetobacter baumannii is called also Arachbacter. It's basically a bacterium that has become associated with the Iraq War, it is in fact an important pathogen with regard to nosocomial infections, and also has multi-drug resistance strains. So this is not anything we need to memorize. This is just to give you a sense of what particularly is out there with regard to antibiotic resistance in bacteria. So this is pneumococcus again, and we're seeing the rates of resistance to antibiotics as seen in pneumococcus, and there is with like these graphs generally a growing trend in antibiotic resistance. This is from Wikipedia. What would we do without Wikipedia? So throughout history, treatment relied primarily on beta-lactam antibiotics. In the 1960s, nearly all strains of Streptococcus pneumoniae were susceptible to penicillin, but since that time, there has been an increasing prevalence of penicillin resistance, especially in areas of high antibiotic use, thereby suggesting natural selection. A varying proportion of strains may also be resistant to cephalosporins, macrolides such as erythromycin, tetracycline, clindamycin, and the quinolones. Penicillin resistant strains are more likely to be resistant to these other antibiotics, which is suggestive that the penicillin resistance is coming in on a plasma that also contains genes that confer resistance to these other antibiotics. Here we have antibiotic resistance on a pig farm and our pig farms. And they are looking at the antibiotic resistance of isolates on farms where antibiotics are used versus farms where antibiotics are not used. And so the lighter colored bars are where antibiotics is not used. And you can see for ampicillin, there's this huge difference, so 30% resistance on the farms where antibiotics are used, and only about 5% resistance on the farms where antibiotics are not used, 1.4% versus 0.09% there, 87% versus 41%, about one half, 77% versus 61%. So you've got this dramatic increase in the amount of antibiotic resistance on these farms that are actually using antibiotics, which is suggestive that natural selection is playing an important role in increasing the prevalence of antibiotic resistant strains. The flip side of this, though, is that you've got antibiotic resistance even in the farms where you don't have antibiotic treatment. So this is telling you really two things. The first is that antibiotic resistance is not a function of human use of antibiotics, or at least not a direct function of that use, or a function of the direct use of antibiotics. It could be that these antibiotic resistant strains are coming from farms where antibiotics are used, however. So it might have something to do with human use of antibiotics. But as we'll see, in fact, antibiotic resistance is not something that was invented only upon the use of antibiotics by humans. And so the other thing is that antibiotics clearly seem to be responding to natural selection. You start throwing antibiotics into a bacterium's environment, and one of the consequences is the evolution of antibiotic resistance. So highly suggestive of antibiotic of selection for increased resistance. This is just a basic rundown of what acquired resistance is all about in bacteria. So you've got a bacterial population, you treat it with an antibiotic, they're all dead. So that means they're all sensitive. Alternatively, you can have mutations occurring within the population. You treat the population with antibiotic, and they're not all dead. Some survive, and then they can reestablish the population if given an opportunity. And in fact, if the pathogens that are circulating are the ones that have been isolated following this antibiotic treatment, then what you end up with is basically pathogens that right from the get-go, it's in terms of their infecting, are antibiotic resistant. And then here you have a population that has acquired a plasmid, presumably that confers antibiotic resistance, and you treat the population with antibiotics, and it's only those individuals that carry that plasmid which are resistant to the antibiotics. So the population becomes reestablished with the antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And then there's a fourth possibility that's not shown, and that is that you're talking about a community of bacteria. Some of them are more resistant to the antibiotic than others. You treat the community with the antibiotic, and what you end up with is antibiotic-resistant bacteria becoming increased in their numbers or frequency within the community. And a good example of that is where you have the development of various antibiotic-associated superinfections, such as that associated with Clostridium difficile. So bacteria-resistant phenotypes are not limited to antibiotics, as we talked about, such as heavy metal resistance, and the mechanisms underlying these other kinds of resistances are just like you see here. In addition, it's important to keep in mind that not all resistance mechanisms displayed by microorganisms are seen in bacteria. So it's not just antibiotic resistance in bacteria, and it's not just bacteria. So you've got drug resistance, for example, evolving in HIV infections as well. How is it that bacteria are resistant or become resistant to antibiotics? There's a number of different mechanisms. For example, the target site of the antibiotic can change such that the antibiotic can't bind to its target anymore. It might not be able to get into the cell. It might, let's see. Well, we've got dun, 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 dun. Oh, that's odd. This isn't actually an efflux pump, and it's not showing it as such here. Well, I guess I'm just noticing that right now. Well, I've got another slide that shows that as well. So you can also have, as a mechanism of resistance, the pumping of antibiotics out of the cells, and then you can have degradation of the antibiotic, such as you see with the enzymes that break down the beta-lactam ring in penicillins, the beta-lactamases. Okay, so here we have a simpler diagrammatic representation of these things that does do a better job of getting things right. This is actually something I stole from an online PowerPoint presentation. It's rather nice. So here you have the antibiotic inactivation, and here you have some means of impermeability. That's what's trying to be shown right here. And this is our friend the efflux pump, so it's actually pumping the drugs out of the cytoplasm, pumping them away from their targets. That's presumably what's trying to be shown here. And then you have altering of the target, which is what's being shown here. And you also have this potential for metabolic bypass. So if you've got a drug that interferes with one aspect of how the bacterium goes about doing things, the bacterium can do the same endpoint successfully. It might be able to survive in the even though it's being exposed to this drug. An example of this sort of is that bacteria can grow in the presence of penicillin so long as they are living in an isotonic environment, so that in fact, even though they don't have a cell wall, they don't need it because they're not going to be lysing as a consequence of osmosis. So we can distinguish among these resistance mechanisms not just in terms of these various general categories of resistant mechanisms, but also in terms of how they're encoded. So, for example, an altered target, such as you see back here in the ribosome, typically is a chromosomally encoded change. In other words, the mutation occurs in the chromosome. And this is because the targets themselves are encoded by the chromosome. So if you're going to change the target, you need to have the mutation occurring in the chromosome. By contrast, the various enzymes that break down the antibiotics, as well as efflux pumps, can be encoded by plasmids, because these are additional pathways or additional proteins that, or additional genes that can be brought into a cell on a plasmid. Impermeability, well, that, I suppose that could be encoded by a plasmid, but also could be a change, for example, in the outer membrane structure of a gram-negative bacterium. A new pathway, well, I suppose that could be encoded by a plasmid as well, but it also could be the result of evolution within the genome, the chromosome of the bacterium itself. So you have this fundamental difference between chromosomal encoding of resistance mechanisms, and generally these are conferred via mutation within the organism that is or is about to be exposed to the antibiotic, whereas you have these other mechanisms that tend to be plasmid encoded, and these tend to be acquired by organisms via horizontal gene transfer. And there's some overlap in terms of what causes what, but by and large, inactivation is caused is a horizontally transferred mechanism. Efflux pumps, I suppose you could have mutation in chromosomes that increase the ability of the efflux pumps to pump things out, or the specificity of those efflux pumps. But also, you can acquire these things on our plasmids, resistance plasmids. So, therefore, we can distinguish resistance to antibiotics into a number of different categories. One of them is innate versus acquired, which we really haven't talked about yet. So innate basically means that the organism lacks whatever it is whatever target it is for an antibiotic. Inherently, and as a consequence, it's simply not going to be susceptible to an antibiotic. So the mycoplasma are cell wall-less bacteria. They are inherently resistant to penicillins, which act upon cell walls. By contrast, there's acquired resistance. So this, for example, is mutationally acquired or acquired via horizontal gene transfer, which is what that says. If it's a mutation, then generally it's chromosomal. So it's things that come in via horizontal gene transfer on plasmids, for example. These too can be modified mutationally. But if you're going from a fully sensitive organism to one that is resistant, and it's occurring as a consequence of mutation, typically it's a change in the target for the antibiotic, and then the change of the target is the result of a change in some gene that is chromosomally encoded. If you're going to be knocking out a target and causing the organism to not function as a consequence, it's probably an important thing you're knocking out, and important things tend to be chromosomally encoded. So usually it's a change in the potential for the antibiotic to either reach or to bind to its target. And so these chromosomal mutational change. And typically there also will be a characteristic mutation rate to resistance. It might be more than one mutation type that can give rise to resistance in this case, but even so, you're going to have some rate that on average represents the likelihood of the organism mutating to antibiotic resistance to a specific antibiotic per round of replication. And then you can use these ideas, as we will, to discuss further how it is we can enhance the likelihood that use of antibiotics will be effective against a given target organism. We can also talk about degrees of resistance. So it's not all black and white. It's not either you're sensitive or you're resistant. There are certainly degrees of resistance that are greater than pure sensitivity. And often we define these degrees of resistance in terms of what are known as minimum inhibitory concentrations. And so that is the minimum amount of drug that is required to inhibit the replication of the target organism, typically as determined in vivo. Oh, sorry, in vitro, in the laboratory. And also important to this idea of minimum inhibitory concentrations is what concentration of antibiotics that you're able to achieve wherever it is the bacteria that you're trying to treat. And in fact, if you can't reach the minimum inhibitory concentrations of your antibiotic in vivo, for example, then the organism, even if it could be controlled if you're able to use unlimited amounts of antibiotic, in fact, will not be sensitive to that antibiotic in vivo, and therefore effectively will be a resistant organism. So resistance is a very important concept, but it's not one that is binary. It's not either you're resistant or you're not resistant. The context of the treatment is a very important component of whether or not the organism actually is going to display effective resistance or not. If it's horizontal gene transferred rather than mutationally generated acquired resistance, then it's typically an extra chromosomal element, a plasmid, that encodes the resistance genes. So these are associated with what are known as resistance plasmids. And resistance plasmids often contain multiple resistance alleles, such that these alleles, these genes, are targeting multiple different potential degradants to the bacterium. So, for example, multiple different antibiotics. And as a consequence of this, when a bacterium acquires antibiotic resistance, it's a consequence of horizontal gene transfer, often they acquire resistance to multiple antibiotics simultaneously. From the perspective of the plasmid, the incoming plasmid, these antibiotic genes are supplying the plasmid a benefit by supplying the host organism a benefit. The host bacterium is not necessarily going to hold on to all the plasmids that it's exposed to, but if the plasmid can supply a useful gene to the host bacterium, then the retention of the plasmid will be selected for. One such useful gene is a gene conferring antibiotic resistance, but there's lots of antibiotics out there. So if you can have a plasmid, if you are a plasmid and you have multiple antibiotic resistance genes that you carry, then the likelihood that your retention will be selected for will be that much higher because, in fact, you're going to be selected, your retention will be selected for upon bacterium exposure to potentially multiple different antibiotics rather than just one particular antibiotic. The plasmid, in other words, doesn't necessarily have to decide, and it hedges its bets so that the likelihood that it's bringing in a gene that's useful to the bacterium is higher. And it does this by spreading its bets by essentially having multiple genes on a given plasmid that might be useful to a given bacterium. And then sequentially, these genes can be useful to the plasmid and the bacterium. So the bacteria might be exposed to one antibiotic today and then might be exposed to another day. And if the plasmid is carrying both of these antibiotic resistance genes, then it's increasing the selection, acting upon it for its retention within the bacterial genome. So next, we're going to consider a little bit more pharmacology associated with antibiotic use. So, and this is important for having a better appreciation of what antibiotic resistance is all about. So what we have here is a curve that graphs the concentration of an antibiotic specifically within the plasma, so that's the plasma of the blood, over time. We have a single dose that's being administered here. When you apply the antibiotic, when you dose of the antibiotic, no matter how you're doing it, it's going to increase in concentration as a consequence of that dosing. If it's an antibiotic that's being used systematically, then it will have to get into the blood. You could be doing a per-os delivery, so oral delivery that then is absorbed into the blood, or you could actually directly inject it into the blood. But it gets into the blood somehow, and there will be some peak density of the antibiotic concentration within the blood, and then various mechanisms will reduce that density. For example, the drug can be metabolized, it can be excreted from the body as it moves throughout the body, as it's distributed throughout the tissues. It's actually going to be diluted down. So there's this decline from its peak density. And in fact, eventually the antibiotic will be lost from the plasma altogether, although that might take some time. Now, what's important for antibiotic treatment is that the drug reaches a minimum effective concentration. So that's a concentration wherever the bacteria happen to be, not necessarily in the plasma, but in here we're kind of showing it as in the plasma. It has to reach a concentration that is able to, in fact, stop the bacteria from growing and perhaps even kill the bacteria. So when you're dosing, your goal is to make sure that wherever the antibiotic needs to be, that it's maintained above some minimum effective concentration. Because what you don't want is for the bacteria that are resistant and therefore haven't been killed off by the antibiotic yet to start growing again before you hit the bacteria with the next dose. This is seen in an extreme when a person stops taking the drugs altogether because the concentration of the drug declines to the point where, in fact, it's no longer effective. The other end is the minimum toxic concentrations. This is where you start seeing side effects, and you want to typically keep the drug below those side effects or the concentrations where the side effects are seen. So you've got this span here between the level of the drug that's necessary for it to even work and the level of drug that's so great that in fact it's starting to cause the patient harm. And the goal with dosing is to basically keep the drug bouncing around inside of this little window here between the minimum toxic dose and the minimum effective dose. So there's going to be limits ultimately on how much antibiotic you can use. Specifically, when you're using an antibiotic as a drug, how much antibiotic you can expose an individual to before you hit this minimum toxic concentration. If in fact the minimum effective concentration is lower than the minimum toxic concentration, then what you have is a sensitive organism. If, however, the minimum effective concentration is at or above the minimum toxic concentration and you're not willing to harm the patient, then what you have is a resistant bacterium. So whether you're sensitive or resistant kind of depends. There's a whole spectrum over that goes from sensitivity, complete sensitivity, to complete resistance. And it's somewhere within that spectrum you'll have a dividing line between usefully sensitive versus sensitive if you can get the concentrations of the antibiotic high enough, but in reality you can't get them that high. So this minimum effective concentration, people often use minimum inhibitory concentration there instead, but my preference is effective concentration because all sorts of things can go wrong in vivo relative to what's happening in the laboratory where the MICs are calculated. So here we have consideration of minimum inhibitory concentration, but first let's talk once again about natural selection for antibiotic resistance. So what we have here is a population. The population has variability associated with it. This variability can be in terms of antibiotic susceptibility. You apply the antibiotic, and what you're going to end up with is a population that has become enriched for those individuals that are more resistant to the antibiotic. Reestablishment of that population, and you have a population that is more resistant to antibiotic than you began with. So going from low resistance to high resistance, you have selection for the higher resistance, and then if you were to stop the drug or stop taking the drug, then the population could reestablish itself, and thus you would have a population that is resistant. Now, how do we define the resistance level? Well, we typically will define it in terms of minimum inhibitory concentrations or MICs. So these are examples of how one determines MICs. So what you have here is a bunch of tubes. They could be wells and microtiter plates, and you have different concentrations of antibiotic in each well. And it's that well that is the minimum antibiotic concentration that doesn't support growth of the organism that is the MIC. You can determine the same kind of thing on a plate. That's a bacterial lawn. That's a disc that's impregnated with an antibiotic, and that's the zone of inhibition around that disc. So if you've got a resistant organism, then what you have is basically a lack of inhibition of its growth. But actually, it's more subtle than that. What you have is a lack of inhibition of an organism's growth at those antibiotic concentrations that can be achieved wherever it is the antibiotic is being used. So if if you get the antibiotic concentration as high as you can get it and the organism is still resistant to the antibiotic, then you have a resistant organism. So here you see a determination of minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC, as done in microtiter plates. So what you have here is growth, and here you have a lack of growth. In fact, on this one here, you've got clearly growth, and then maybe a little less growth, and seemingly even less growth, and just a tiny bit of growth, and maybe even a little teensy-weensy bit of growth here. So where exactly does the minimum inhibitory concentration lie here? Difficult to say. Probably lies here for that antibiotic and probably lies there for that antibiotic. Though even here, you can see that there's some diminishment of growth above the antibiotic, the threshold, at antibiotic levels that are sufficiently low that they're below the minimum inhibitory concentration. So here we have higher, 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 and here we have minimum inhibitory concentration. Here we have below minimum inhibitory concentration. And here we see a determination of zones of inhibitions on a plate, and it's the width of these zones that defines the minimum inhibitory concentration. This is dependent upon the concentrations of antibiotic and as they're diffusing out of these discs and what concentrations they can reach some distance away from the discs. If the concentration that they can reach is one that's attainable within the body and the organism is not able to grow at that concentration, then you have a sufficiently strong, sufficiently sensitive bacterium. The minimum inhibitory concentration is basically found right on the edge here. Of course, you don't know what the concentration is, which is why we have this next technique. So here we see a way of determining minimum inhibitory concentration on a plate. This is a petri dish. And it is based upon also impregnation of filter paper with antibiotic. But here, the antibiotic is impregnated on a, in a concentration gradient so that the higher concentrations are here and the lower concentrations are down here. And this is the zone of inhibition. But as the concentration of antibiotic declines, you can see that the zone of inhibition becomes narrower and narrower and narrower. And they've set it up so that at the point where the zone of inhibition line here crosses the filter paper, that's the minimum inhibitory concentration. Remember, the minimum inhibitory concentration is what you're seeing right just inside of this line here. And so they've simply marked the filter paper in such a way that where it crosses, that's equal to the concentration that constitutes the minimum inhibitory concentration of the antibiotic on this particular organism. Notice that it's a slightly different amount on this particular organism, although actually not too different. And it's definitely a substantially different amount on for this organism. So here we've returned to our pigs. And remember, we've got pigs on farms where antibiotics are used and pigs on farms where antibiotics are not used. So used and not used. And what we're looking at here is ampicillin resistance in E. coli. And you can see a substantial difference between the amount of resistance of E. coli on the farms where antibiotics are used versus where they're not. So used, not. I mean, that's pretty impressive. But getting back to MIC, they're actually calculating resistance in terms of MIC. So the higher the minimum inhibitory concentration, remember this is the concentration of the antibiotic, the more resistant the bacterium is. So you're seeing substantial differences here in terms of MIC for the specific antibiotic ampicillin. So the lower the MHC, sorry, the lower the MIC, the more sensitive the organism is. So this H should be an I. The lower the MIC, the more sensitive an organism is. That's essentially by definition. And the higher the, I don't know why I put H's instead of I's here, the higher the MIC, the more difficult it is to attain effective treatment densities at the site where bacteria are present, particularly within bodies. So this organism is going to require a higher concentration of antibiotic in order to bring under control than this organism is. And if the highest point that you're willing to go with in terms of concentrations of antibiotics is, say, right here, then that organism is resistant and that organism is sensitive. And just to explain the graph a little better, right down here you've got different groups of pigs and they're being divided up in terms of the size of their bodies, the mass of their bodies. As well as the sows, which are sitting right here. So this is mommy pig, and these are baby pigs.